It is also important to understand that in the era of Accountability 2.0, due diligence typically will be more expansive and will probe more deeply than ever before. Accordingly, due diligence will take longer and be costlier, especially if the prospective buyer is a public company or a company with plans to go public within the next 18 months. A prime example of the need for heightened due diligence is provided by the articulated policy of the U.S. Department of Justice, DOJ, relating to enforcement of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, FCPA. At its most basic level, the FCPA prohibits U.S. and certain foreign companies from bribing foreign government officials. A discussion of the many pitfalls a buyer can encounter under the FCPA in acquiring a company that may have violated the FCPA is beyond the scope of this chapter. The FCPA is a strong example because the DOJ has issued written guidance effectively announcing that it is less likely to take harsh enforcement action against a company that purchases another company that has violated the FCPA if the buyer has, 1, conducted extensive FCPA-oriented due diligence, 2, obtained certain representations and warranties from the seller, 3, made voluntary disclosures to the DOJ, and 4, implemented structural compliance safeguards. The DOJ guidance is very fact-specific, and therefore is not generically applicable to all buyers facing potential FCPA issues. However, with an ever-increasing number of cross-border acquisitions in the global M&A marketplace, the current environment heightens the need for buyers who are examining certain foreign targets to undertake extensive FCPA due diligence. Returning to the fundamentals of due diligence, the seller's team must organize the documents and prepare the data room. Although electronic data rooms, which are especially important to cross-border M&A transactions, have improved the efficiency of the due diligence process, the seller still must commit substantial resources to assembling the documents. The buyer's team must be prepared to ask all the right questions as it conducts a detailed analysis of the documents provided and prepares for in-person interviews and follow-on requests. To the extent that the deal is structured as a merger, or where the seller will be taking the buyer's stock as all or part of its compensation, the process of due diligence is likely to be a two-way street as the parties gather background information on each other. The due diligence work is usually divided between two working teams. One, the financial and strategic team, which is typically managed by the buyer's management team with assistance from its accountants, and two, the legal team, which involves the buyer's counsel with appropriate assistance from technical experts such as environmental engineers and export compliance specialists, depending on the nature of the target's business. Throughout the process, both teams compare notes on open issues and potential risks and problems. The legal due diligence focuses on potential legal issues and problems that may prove to be impediments to the transaction. It also sheds light on how the transaction should be structured and the contents of the transaction documents, such as the representations and warranties. The business due diligence focuses on the strategic and financial issues in the transaction, such as confirmation of the past financial performance of the seller, integration of the human and financial resources of the two companies, confirmation of the operating, production, and distribution synergies and economies of scale to be achieved by the acquisition, and the collection of information necessary for financing the transaction. Overall, the due diligence process, when done properly, can be tedious, frustrating, time-consuming, and expensive. For example, one FCPA due diligence effort cited in a DOJ opinion encompassed a review of at least 4 million electronic documents, requiring nearly 45,000 hours of mostly lawyer time. Fortunately, many transactions will not require such an extensive effort. Yet, detailed due diligence is a necessary prerequisite to a well-planned acquisition, and it can be quite informative and revealing in its analysis of the target company and its measures of the costs and risks associated with the transaction. Buyers should expect sellers to become defensive, evasive, and impatient during the due diligence phase of the transaction. Most business owners and executives do not enjoy having their business policies and decisions under the microscope, especially for an extended period of time, and will only tolerate so many rounds of nitpicking. Eventually, the seller is likely to give the prospective buyer an ultimatum: finish the due diligence soon or the deal is off. When negotiations have reached this point, it is best to end the examination process soon thereafter to stay focused on a short list of bona fide concerns. Buyers should resist the temptation to conduct a hasty once-over, either to save costs or to appease the seller. Yet at the same time, they should avoid due diligence overkill, keeping in mind that due diligence is not a perfect process and should not be a tedious fishing expedition. Like any audit, a due diligence process is designed to answer the important questions and provide reasonable assurance that the seller's claims about the business are fair and legitimate. There are, of course, exceptions in which the buyer faces structural constraints on conducting thorough due diligence. These include acquisitions of bankrupt companies under Section 363 of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code. Although companies that are in Chapter 11 proceedings typically provide for some due diligence by prospective buyers who wish to submit bids, the representations and warranties that may be crafted in response to the buyer's due diligence are somewhat less meaningful than in non-bankruptcy transactions, because frequently there is no ongoing indemnification obligation on the part of the estate of the bankrupt seller. In addition to the bankruptcy context, the increasingly common use of auctions managed by investment banks or other financial advisors has affected early-stage due diligence activities. While sellers typically permit interested bidders to examine data room documents and submit follow-on questions, full-scale due diligence generally is not permitted until the seller has selected the winning bidder following a review of the prospective buyer's markups of a proposed acquisition agreement. Buyers frequently propose numerous additional revisions to the acquisition agreement based on their subsequent due diligence, but sellers often impose tight deadlines on the winning bidders and otherwise attempt to limit the due diligence-driven revisions to a bare minimum. Whatever the type of transaction, there is always the possibility that critical information may slip through the cracks, which is precisely why broad representations, warranties, liability holdbacks, and indemnification provisions should be included in the final purchase agreement, at least in a non-bankruptcy context. Representations and warranties may still be important in a bankruptcy context if there is a temporal gap between signing and closing upon receiving bankruptcy court approval. The buyer may be able to terminate the transaction if there is a material breach of an important representation and warranty provision prior to the closing, even if the representation and warranty is often meaningless in terms of giving rise to post-closing indemnification claims. Of course, some Section 363 transactions do involve escrowed funds that are available for a short while to satisfy limited indemnification claims. These provisions protect the buyer while the seller negotiates for carve-outs, for example, a minimum basket of liabilities before the buyer may seek reimbursement for undisclosed or unexpected liabilities, exceptions, and limitations on liability that provide post-closing protections. To the extent that the seller is able to negotiate favorable limits on the seller's liability, including the period during which the buyer may assert claims, referred to as the survival period for representations and warranties, the indemnification provisions may in fact benefit the seller more than the buyer. Likewise, sophisticated sellers will try to include a disclaimer in the acquisition agreement, providing that the buyer is relying only on the representations and warranties in the four corners of the agreement. Such a clause frequently prevents a buyer from bringing fraud claims against the seller. Fraud claims are considered tort actions rather than contract actions, and if successful, allow the buyer to circumvent the negotiated contractual limits on the seller's liability. The nature and scope of all these provisions are likely to be hotly contested in the negotiations. However, buyers should not become so preoccupied with the minutiae and emotion attending these negotiations that they lose sight of the big picture. Remember that the key objective of due diligence is not only to confirm that the deal makes sense, for example, to confirm the factual assumptions and preliminary valuations underlying the terms by which the buyer negotiates the transaction, but also to determine whether the transaction should proceed at all. The buyer must recognize at all times that there may be a need to terminate negotiations if the risks or potential liabilities in the transaction greatly exceed what is anticipated and there is no effective way to insure against them or otherwise compensate the buyer for assuming such risks and liabilities. As stated earlier, effective due diligence is both an art and a science. The art is the style and experience to know which questions to ask and how and when to ask them. It is the ability to create an atmosphere of both trust and fear in the seller that encourages full and complete disclosure. In this sense, the due diligence team is on a risk discovery and assessment mission, looking for potential problems and liabilities, the search, and finding ways to resolve these problems prior to closing and to ensure that risks are allocated fairly and openly after the closing. The science of due diligence is in the preparation of comprehensive and customized checklists of the specific questions to be presented to the seller, in maintaining a methodical system for organizing and analyzing the documents and data provided by the seller, and in quantitatively assessing the risks raised by those problems that are discovered in the process. One of the key areas is detection of the seller's obligations, particularly those that the buyer will be expected or required to assume after closing, especially in a stock purchase transaction or comparable merger. In an asset purchase, purchased liabilities are specifically defined, subject to a few successor liabilities that cannot be contractually avoided. The due diligence process is designed first to detect the existence of the obligations, and second, to identify any defaults or problems in connection with these obligations that will affect the buyer after closing. The best way for the buyer to ensure that virtually no stone remains unturned is through effective due diligence preparation and planning. Astute buyers typically employ comprehensive due diligence checklists that are intended to guide the company's management team while it works closely with counsel to gather and review all legal documents that may be relevant to the structure and pricing of the transaction, to assess the potential legal risks and liabilities to the buyer following the closing, and to identify all of the consents, approvals, and notifications that may be required from or to third parties and government agencies. The most common form of third-party consent is that required in connection with existing contracts that cannot be assigned or otherwise transferred without the counterparty's prior approval. A due diligence checklist, however, should be a guideline, not a crutch. The buyer's management team must take the lead in developing questions that pertain to the nature of the seller's business. These questions will set the pace for the level of detail and adequacy of the review. The key point here is that every type of business has its own issues and problems, and a standard set of questions will rarely be sufficient. Some of the more common mistakes made during the process are set forth here. Common mistakes made by the buyer during the due diligence investigation. 1. Mismatch between the documents provided by the seller and the skills of the buyer's review team. The seller may have particularly complex financial statements or highly technical reports that must be truly understood by the buyer's due diligence team. Make sure that there is a capability fit. 2. Poor communication and misunderstandings. The communication between the teams of the buyer and the seller should be open and clear. The process must be well orchestrated. 3. Lack of planning and focus in the preparation of the due diligence questionnaires and in the interviews with the seller's team. The focus must be on asking the right questions, not just a lot of questions. Sellers will resent wasteful fishing expeditions when the buyer's team is unfocused. 4. Inadequate time devoted to tax and financial matters. The buyers and sellers, CFO and CPA, must play an integral part in the due diligence process in order to gather data on past financial performance and tax reporting, unusual financial events, or disturbing trends or inefficiencies. 5. Lack of reasonable accommodations and support for the buyer's due diligence team. The buyer must insist that its team be treated like welcome guests, not like enemies from the IRS. Many times, buyer's counsel is sent to a dark room in a corner of the building to inspect documents without coffee, windows, or phones. It will enhance and expedite the transaction if the seller provides reasonable accommodations and support for the buyer's due diligence team. 6. Ignoring the real story behind the numbers. The buyer and its team must dig deep into the financial data and test and retest the value proposition as to whether the deal truly makes sense. They must ask themselves, does the real value truly justify the price? The economics of the deal may not hold water once a realistic look at cost allocation, inventory turnover, and capacity utilization is taken into account. Due diligence surprises can come in varying shapes and sizes, each with varying degrees of severity. Also, the current crisis of disengagement is impacting due diligence. The crisis of disengagement and its impact on due diligence. Our global economy is fighting an epidemic of alarming proportions. It is not cancer, intolerance, racial divides, terrorism, cyber attacks, hunger, access to clean water, or the technology gap, although unfortunately all of those social epidemics remain firmly in place. Rather, it is a disease affecting the central nervous system of our economy, and it is destroying creativity, innovation, productivity, profitability, and overall enterprise value. This epidemic is a societal and workplace challenge costing hundreds of billions of dollars a year in the United States, a calamity so large that it could literally reverse the trend of our evolution if not soon corrected. It is the crisis of disengagement, and it is having a direct impact on corporate venturing, innovation, and the ability of a company to strategically harvest its intangible assets. For example, in the United States, in the December 2016 update to Gallup's State of the American Workplace, as well as in recent studies by the Conference Board and many other prominent organizations, researchers have found that fewer than 30% of Americans are somewhat satisfied with their work and their career paths. The remaining 70% are somewhat or highly dissatisfied, citing inadequate challenge, pay, morale, sense of purpose, or lack of appreciation at the heart of their disdain. Many are bored, which eviscerates productivity and the ability to innovate, and in turn affects the profitability of companies and the ability to remain competitive in the world market. Listeners of this book, whether as intermediaries and investment bankers, principals or executives, corporate development teams, M&A lawyers, accountants, and valuation experts, need to understand and embrace this disturbing trend in our workforce and deal with it in a wide variety of ways, from M&A structure, post-closing integration, strategic due diligence, valuation, fairness opinions, etc., all of which may be affected by varying levels of employee or other types of disengagement. Gallup 2016 State of the American Workplace poll. 31.5% of U.S. workforce defines themselves as engaged. 51% are not engaged, disconnected. 17.5% are actively disengaged. It is hard to imagine that a disengaged workforce that spends the bulk of its time being distracted and dissatisfied will ever be a catalyst for the creativity and productivity in an enterprise or devote itself to driving long-term shareholder or enterprise value. It is equally hard to imagine an employee who feels disconnected and unappreciated spending time thinking about ways to be more efficient in his or her workplace, work with team members, or see new ways to improve the company's current products and services. And it is harder still to imagine a disengaged manager spending the necessary time to figure out how to better engage employees. Innovation within the organization, also known as entrepreneurship, refers to the actions and initiatives that transform organizations through strategic renewal processes. Firms that consistently demonstrate durable corporate innovation are typically viewed as dynamic entities prepared to take advantage of new business opportunities when they arise, with a willingness to deviate from prior strategies and business models, to embrace new resource combinations that hold promise for new innovations. These companies tend to attract higher valuations in private financing, M&A transactions, strategic investments, and initial public offerings. There have been numerous articles and books written over the years advocating the importance of unleashing the entrepreneurial potential of individuals by removing constraints on entrepreneurial behavior to drive enterprise value. See, for example, Gary Hamel's Leading the Revolution, Gifford Pinchot's Intrapreneuring, and my 2012 book, Harvesting Intangible Assets. Employees engaging in entrepreneurial behavior are the foundation for organizational innovation. In order to develop a culture of corporate innovation, organizations must establish a process through which individuals in an established firm pursue entrepreneurial opportunities to innovate without regard to the level and nature of currently available resources. However, keep in mind that in the absence of proper control mechanisms, firms that manifest corporate innovation activity may tend to generate an incoherent mass of interesting but unrelated opportunities that may have profit potential, but that don't move those firms toward a desirable future. Research also shows that engaged workers are more likely to foster a collaborative and innovative atmosphere among fellow employees by reacting positively to creative ideas of others on their team. A good example of this is Google, which fosters a variety of channels to enhance employee engagement through connectivity and the sharing of ideas. Some of the avenues for expression that the company facilities include having Google cafes, which serve as venues for individuals to interact across their regular team, or Google moderators, a management tool that was created to allow anyone within the company to posit questions they would like to have answered. Through the moderator channel, employees can view existing ideas, questions, and suggestions. This generates a symbiotic relationship between innovation and employee engagement, creating an inertial atmosphere. For decades, workers were expected to know their jobs, do their work, keep their heads down, and only bother management with questions to avert a crisis. If a problem arises, know how and when to solve it, and don't interfere with the supervisor's valuable time. That mantra needs to shift if we are going to improve engagement in a way that will drive more innovation and upticks in shareholder value. Employees at all levels need to be liberated to ask the whys and the what-ifs. They need to be able to ask, without retribution or punishment, why am I doing my job the way I am doing it? Is there a better way? What would it take to change, and why? Empowering your teams to ask questions also demonstrates humility by the leadership team by admitting that they don't know all the answers, and it gives permission to the workforce to begin to organize its thinking around the unknowns instead of the knowns, which will foster greater creativity, innovation, and productivity. There are already a wide variety of human capital challenges in M&A transactions, ranging for a complex web of federal, state, local employment laws and regulations, compliance issues, union laws, retirement and compensation issues, general cultural issues, succession planning, leadership and governance, and the impact of automation and robotics as we begin to contemplate the workplace of the future. This recently recognized crisis of disengagement raises new and more granular challenges in M&A, private equity, and strategic or venture financing's due diligence. Nobody wants or intends to invest in or buy a company with a distracted, dysfunctional, or disengaged workforce. And no company will ever reach its full operational potential or maximum enterprise valuation with apathetic and disconnected workers. Post-closing synergies and integration success are also highly unlikely when one or more of the buyer or seller's human capital assets are grossly underperforming or feeling deeply underappreciated and focused on almost anything but their core tasks at hand. Leadership and governance teams on both sides of the transaction, as well as their advisors, are often either in denial as to the extent of the problem or lack the strategic tools to remedy the key challenges. Sellers engaged in pre-transaction mock due diligence exercises need to be prepared for this new category of due diligence questions surrounding levels of engagement, and buyers and their advisors need to develop strategic due diligence skills around those concerns. Not too far down the road, activist shareholders and other affected third parties could possibly bring legal actions against leaders of buyers and sellers who ignore the importance of employee engagement levels and overall cultural performance in their due diligence and analysis of transactions, and where mergers and acquisitions are underperforming on a post-closing basis as a result of this crisis. What role can M&A principals and advisors play? Strengthen your HR cultural-related due diligence analytical skills and approaches. Bring in subject matter experts, SMEs, and specialists as needed. Focus on these issues in pre-due diligence mock reviews. Understand the connections between high levels of disengagement and the impact on other aspects of the business model operations. For example, customer service, innovation, recruitment, brand, social media, etc. Work with legal counsel with strong L&D skills and strategic understanding of disengagement issues. Closely examine the alignment of reward compensation systems with workplace performance and engagement. Advise buy-side engagement clients on the risks of acquiring low-engagement companies. Look for disengagement warning signs in due diligence on the seller, that is, dysfunctional leadership, high turnover rates, an excess of negative social media posts on job-related or other websites or platforms, lack of succession planning or obvious turfmanship or protectionism in leadership positions, declining rates of profitability, lack of innovation, etc. Challenge buyers who think they have the magic elixir for curing cultural or employee performance defects on a post-closing basis. Oh, this won't be a problem once we buy them. Yeah, right? For example, I worked on a deal that involved the purchase of a hockey league in the Midwest. It was easy to prepare the standard due diligence list and draw up questions regarding corporate structure and history, the status of the stadium leases and team tax returns, and to question the steps that had been taken to protect the team trademarks. The more difficult task was developing a customized list. In my role as legal counsel, I asked my client the question, "If you were buying a sports league, what would you need to review?" As stated earlier, every type of business has its own issues and problems. The list for this client included player and coaching contracts, stadium signage and promotional leases, league-wide and local team sponsorship contracts, the immigration status of each player, team and player performance statistics, the status of contracts with each team's star players, scouting reports and drafting procedures, ticket sales, including walk-up, advance, season, group tickets, and coupons for each team and game, promotional agreements with equipment suppliers and providers of game day merchandise, food and beverage concession contracts, the status of each team's franchise agreement, commitments made to cities for future teams, and unique per-team advertising rates for Dasher boards, the signs for advertising that surround the rink. When done properly, due diligence is performed in multiple stages. First, all the basic data are gathered and specific topics are identified. Follow-up questions and additional data gathering can be performed in subsequent rounds of due diligence. They must be custom-tailored to the target's core business industry trends and unique challenges. The legal due diligence checklist in the following section is intended to guide the company's management team while it works closely with counsel to gather and review all legal documents that may be relevant to the structure and pricing of the transaction, to assess the potential legal risks and liabilities to the buyer following the closing, and to identify all of the consents and approvals, such as an existing contract that can't be assigned without consent, which must be obtained from third parties and government agencies. Following the high-level suggestions in this overview of M&A due diligence best practices will not ensure that the parties to a transaction have successfully negotiated the rapids of the era of accountability 2.0. However, compliance with the best practices will go a long way toward keeping their transaction from joining the ranks of failed M&A deals that have plagued the economy in recent years. Legal due diligence. In analyzing the company for sale, the buyer's team carefully reviews and analyzes the following legal documents and records where applicable. 1. Corporate matters. A. Corporate records of the seller. Certificate of incorporation and all amendments. Bylaws as amended. Minute books, including resolutions and minutes of all directors and shareholders' meetings. Current shareholders' list, certified by the corporate secretary. Annual reports to shareholders and stock transfer books. A list of all states, countries, and other jurisdictions in which the seller transacts business or is qualified to do business. Applications or other filings in each state listed in 5 for qualification as a foreign corporation and evidence of qualification. Locations of business offices, including overseas. B. Agreements among the seller's shareholders. C. All contracts restricting the sale or transfer of shares of the company, such as buy-sell agreements, subscription agreements, offeree questionnaires, or contractual rights of first refusal, all agreements for the right to purchase shares, such as stock options or warrants, and any pledge agreements by an individual shareholder involving the seller's shares. 2. Financial matters. A. Copies of management and similar reports or memoranda relating to the material aspects of the business operations or products. B. Letters of counsel in response to auditors' requests for the preceding 5 years. C. Reports of independent accountants to the board of directors for the preceding 5 years. D. Revolving credit and term loan agreements, indentures, and other debt instruments, including without limitation all documents relating to shareholder loans. E. Correspondence with principal lenders to the seller. F. Personal guarantees of the seller's indebtedness by its shareholders or other parties. G. Agreements by the seller where it has served as a guarantor for the obligations of third parties. H. Federal, state, and local tax returns and correspondence with federal, state, and local tax officials. I. Federal filings regarding the subchapter S status of the seller, where applicable. J. Any private placement memorandum, assuming, of course, that the seller is not a Securities Act of 1934 reporting company, prepared and used by the seller, as well as any document used in lieu of a private placement memorandum, such as an investment profile or a business plan. K. Financial statements of the seller, which should be prepared in accordance with GAAP for the past 5 years, including annual audited balance sheets, monthly or other available balance sheets, annual audited and monthly or other available earnings statements, annual audited and monthly or other available statements of shareholders' equity and changes in financial position, any recently prepared projections for the seller, notes and material assumptions for all statements described in K-1-5. L. Any information or documentation relating to tax assessments, deficiency notices, investigations, audits, or settlement proposals. M. An informal schedule of key management compensation, listing information for at least the 10 most highly compensated management employees or consultants. N. Financial aspects of overseas operations, where applicable, including the status of foreign legislation, regulatory restrictions, intellectual property protection, exchange controls, methods for repatriating profits, foreign manufacturing, government controls, import-export licensing and tariffs, and so on. O. Projected budgets, accounts receivable reports, including a detailed aging report, turnover, bad debt experience and reserves, and related information. 3. Management and employment matters. A. All employment agreements. B. Agreements relating to consulting, management, financial advisory services, and other professional engagements. C. Copies of all union contracts and collective bargaining agreements. D. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, and any state equivalent compliance files. E. Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, files, including safety records and workers' compensation claims. F. Employee benefit plans, and copies of literature issued to employees describing such plans, including the following. Pension and retirement plans, including union pension or retirement plans. Annual reports for pension plans, if any. Profit-sharing plans. Stock option plans, including information concerning all options, stock appreciation rights, and other stock-related benefits granted by the company. Medical and dental plans. Insurance plans and policies, including errors and omissions policies and directors and officers' liability insurance policies. Any employee stock ownership plan, ESOP, and trust agreement. Severance pay plans or programs. All other benefit or incentive plans or arrangements not covered by the foregoing, including welfare benefit plans. G. All current contract agreements with or pertaining to the seller, and to which directors, officers, or shareholders of the seller are parties, and any documents relating to any other transactions between the seller and any director, officer, or shareholders, including receivables from or payables to directors, officers, or shareholders. H. All policy and procedures manuals of the seller concerning personnel, hiring and promotional practices, compliance with the Family Leave Act, drug and alcohol abuse policies, AIDS policies, sexual harassment policies, vacation and holiday policies, expense reimbursement policies, and so on. I. The name, address, phone number, and personnel file of any officer or key employee who has left the seller within the past 3 years. 4. Tangible and intangible assets of the seller. A. List of all commitments for rented or leased real and personal property, including location and address, description, terms, options, termination and renewal rights, policies regarding ownership of improvements, and annual costs. B. List of all real property owned, including location and address, description of general character, easements, rights of way, encumbrances, zoning restrictions, surveys, mineral rights, title insurance, pending and threatened condemnation, hazardous waste pollution, and so on. C. List of all tangible assets. D. List of all liens on all real properties and material tangible assets. E. Mortgages, deeds, title insurance policies, leases, and other agreements relating to the properties of the seller. F. Real estate tax bills for the real estate of the seller. G. List of patents, patents pending, trademarks, trade names, copyrights, registered and proprietary internet addresses, franchises, licenses, and all other intangible assets, including registration numbers, expiration dates, employee invention agreements and policies, actual or threatened infringement actions, licensing agreements, and copies of all correspondence relating to this intellectual property. H. Copies of any survey, appraisal, engineering, or other reports relating to the properties of the seller. I. List of assets that may be held on a consignment basis, or that may be the property of a given customer, such as machine dies, molds, and so on. 5. Material contracts and obligations of the seller. A. Material purchase, supply, and sale agreements currently outstanding or projected to come to fruition within 12 months, including the following. List of all contracts relating to the purchase of products, equipment, fixtures, tools, dyes, supplies, industrial supplies, or other materials having a price under any such contract in excess of $5,000. List of all unperformed sales contracts. B. Documents incidental to any planned expansion of the seller's facilities. C. Consignment agreements. D. Research agreements. E. Franchise, licensing, distribution, and agency agreements. F. Joint venture agreements. G. Agreements for the payment or receipt of license fees or royalties and royalty-free licenses. H. Documentation relating to all property, liability, and casualty insurance policies owned by the seller, including for each policy a summary description of coverage, policy type and number, insurer, carrier, and broker, premium, expiration date, deductible, any material changes in any of the foregoing since the inception of the seller, claims made under such policies. I. Agreements restricting the seller's right to compete in any business. J. Agreements for the seller's current purchase of services, including without limitation consulting and management. K. Contracts for the purchase, sale, or removal of electricity, gas, water, telephone, sewage, power, or any other utility service. L. List of waste dumps, disposal, treatment, and storage sites. M. Agreements with any railroad, trucking, or other transportation company or courier service. N. Letters of credit. O. Copies of any special benefits under contracts or government programs that might be in jeopardy as a result of the proposed transaction. For example, small business or minority set-asides, intra-family transactions or favored pricing, internal leases or allocations, and so on. P. Copies of licenses, permits, and government approvals applied for or issued to the seller that are required in order to operate the businesses of the seller, such as zoning, energy requirements, natural gas, fuel, oil, electricity, and so on, operating permits, or health and safety certificates. Note, this section is critical and will be one key area of the negotiations as discussed in Chapter 11. Therefore, it is suggested that the buyer and its advisory team request copies of all material contracts and obligations of the seller, and then organize them as follows. Schedule of all contracts and obligations of seller that are to be assumed by buyer after closing. Status of each contract or obligation. Sample responses. Current. Received notice of default on blank, 20 blank. Cured on blank, 20 blank. Notice of default received. Default not yet cured. To what extent will third-party consents be required for the assignment or assumption of these contracts or obligations? Sample responses, not required, consent to assignment requested blank, 20 blank, and obtained blank, 20 blank. Consent to assumption required, but not yet requested. 6. Litigation and claims, actual and contingent. A. Opinion letter from each lawyer or law firm prosecuting or defending significant litigation to which the seller is a party, describing such litigation. B. list of material litigation or claims for more than $5,000 against the seller, asserted or threatened with respect to the quality of the products or services sold to customers, warranty claims, disgruntled employees, product liability, government actions, tort claims, breaches of contract, and so on, including pending or threatened claims. C. List of settlement agreements, releases, decrees, orders, or arbitration awards affecting the seller. D. Description of labor relations history. E. Documentation regarding correspondence or proceedings with federal, state, or local regulatory agencies. Note: Be sure to obtain specific representations and warranties from the seller and its advisors regarding any knowledge pertaining to potential or contingent claims or litigation. 7. Miscellaneous. A. Press releases, past 2 years. B. Resumes of all key members of the management team. C. Press clippings, past 2 years. D. Financial analyst reports, industry surveys, and so on. E. Texts of speeches by the seller's management team, especially if reprinted and distributed to the industry or the media. F. Schedule of all outside advisors, consultants, and so on, used by the seller over the past 5 years, domestic and international. G. Schedule of long-term investments made by the seller. H. Standard forms used, purchase orders, sales orders, service agreements, and so on. The buyer's acquisition team and its legal counsel gathered data to answer the following 10 legal questions during the legal phase of due diligence. 1. What legal steps will need to be taken to effectuate the transaction? For example, is director and stockholder approval needed, or are there share transfer restrictions or restrictive covenants in loan documentation? Has the appropriate corporate authority been obtained to proceed with the agreement? What key third-party consents, for example, FCC, DOJ, lenders, venture capitalists, landlords, or key customers, are required? 2. What antitrust problems, if any, are raised by the transaction? Will filing with the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, be necessary under the pre-merger notification provisions of the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act? 3. Will the transaction be exempt from registration under applicable federal and state securities laws under the sale of business doctrine? 4. What significant legal problems or issues are affecting the seller now or are likely to affect the seller in the foreseeable future? What potential adverse tax consequences to the buyer, the seller, and their respective shareholders may be triggered by the transaction? 5. What are the potential post-closing risks and obligations of the buyer? To what extent should the seller be held liable for such potential liabilities? What steps, if any, can be taken to reduce these potential risks or liabilities? What will it cost to implement these steps? 6. What are the impediments to the assignability of key tangible and intangible assets of the seller company that are desired by the buyer, such as real estate, intellectual property, favorable contracts or leases, human resources, or plant and equipment? 7. What are the obligations and responsibilities of the buyer and the seller under applicable environmental and hazardous waste laws, such as the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, CERCLA? 8. What are the obligations and responsibilities of the buyer and the seller to the creditors of the seller? For example, bulk transfer laws under Article 6 of the applicable state's commercial code. 9. What are the obligations and responsibilities of the buyer and the seller under applicable federal and state labor and employment laws? For example, will the buyer be subject to successor liability under federal labor laws and as a result be obligated to recognize the presence of organized labor and therefore be obligated to negotiate existing collective bargaining agreements? 10. To what extent will employment, consulting, confidentiality, or non-competition agreements need to be created or modified in connection with the proposed transaction? Business and strategic due diligence. At the same time, as legal counsel is performing its legal investigation of the seller's company, the buyer assembles a management team to conduct business and strategic due diligence. The level and extent of this general business and strategic due diligence will vary depending on the experience of the buyer in the seller's industry and its familiarity with the target company. For example, a financial buyer who is entering a new industry and has no prior experience with the seller should conduct an exhaustive due diligence, not only on the seller's company, but also on any relevant trends within the industry that might directly or indirectly affect the deal. In contrast, a management buyout by a group of industry veterans who have been with the seller for an extended period of time will probably require only a minimum amount of business or strategic due diligence. In this case, the focus will be on legal due diligence and the assessment and assumption of risk. In conducting the due diligence from a business perspective, the buyer's team is likely to encounter a wide variety of financial problems and risk areas when analyzing the seller. These typically include an undervaluation of inventory, overdue tax liabilities, inadequate management information systems, related party transactions, especially in small, closely held companies, an unhealthy reliance on a few key customers or suppliers, aging accounts receivable, unrecorded liabilities, for example, warranty claims, vacation pay, claims, and sales returns and allowances, or an immediate need for significant expenditures as a result of obsolete equipment, inventory, or computer systems. Each of these problems poses different risks and costs for the acquiring company, and these risks must be weighed against the benefits to be gained from the transaction. Note that in view of the significant upheaval in the global economy following the credit crisis and ripple effect events, any type of due diligence will have to include the heightened scrutiny that is demanded by the new order of due diligence best practices. For the buyer who is just getting to know the seller's industry, the following two basic questions should be asked. 1. How would you define the market or markets in which the seller operates? What steps will you take to expedite your learning curve for trends within these markets? What third-party advisors are qualified to advise you on key trends affecting this industry? 2. What are the factors that determine success or failure within this industry? How does the seller stack up? What are the image and reputation of the seller within the industry? Does it have a niche? Is the seller's market share increasing or decreasing? Why? What steps can be taken to enhance or reverse these trends? The following checklist is designed to provide the acquisition team with a starting point for analysis of the seller. It helps to level the playing field in the negotiations, since the seller usually starts with greater expertise regarding its industry and its business. Here are some examples. This checklist is not intended to be exhaustive, of the topic areas and specific questions that should be addressed in due diligence on a given seller. The seller's management team. 1. Has the seller's organization chart been carefully reviewed? How are management functions and responsibilities delegated and implemented? Are job descriptions and employment manuals, among other similar documents, current and available? 2. What is the general assessment of employee morale at the lower echelons of the corporate ladder? To what extent are these rank-and-file employees critical to the seller's long-term health? 3. What are the future growth prospects for the principal labor markets that the seller depends on for attracting key employees? Are employees with the necessary skills generally available? How are the seller's employees recruited, evaluated, trained, and rewarded? 4. What are the background and experience of the seller's key management team? What is the reputation of this management team within the industry? Has there been high turnover among the seller's top management? Why or why not? Who are the seller's key professional advisors and outside consultants? 5. What are the basic management styles, practices, and strategies of the seller's current team? What are the strengths and weaknesses of the management team? To what extent has the seller's current management engaged in long-term strategic planning, developed internal controls, or structured management and marketing information systems? Operations of the seller. 1. What are the seller's production and distribution methods? to what extent are these methods protected, either by contract or by proprietary rights? Have copies of the seller's brochures and reports describing the seller and its products and services been obtained? 2. To what extent is the seller operating at its maximum capacity? Why? What are the significant risk factors, for example, dependence on raw materials or key suppliers or customers, affecting the seller's production capacity and ability to expand? What are the significant costs of producing the seller's goods and services? To what extent are the seller's production and output dependent on economic cycles or seasonal factors? Note: obtain a breakdown of major sales by specific product and specific customer categories in order to fully assess the seller's financial performance, dependence on key customers, or product line susceptibility to risk. 3. Are the seller's plant, equipment, supplies, and machinery in good working order? When will these assets need to be replaced? What are the annual maintenance and service costs for these key assets? At what levels are the seller's inventories? What are the break-even production efficiency and inventory turnover rates for the target company? And how do these compare with industry norms? 4. Does the seller maintain production plans, schedules, and reports? Have copies been obtained and analyzed by the buyer? What are the seller's manufacturing and production obligations pursuant to long-term contracts or other arrangements? What long-term, post-closing obligations or commitments for the purchase of raw materials or other supplies or resources have been made? 5. What is the status of the seller's inventories, for example, the amount and balance in raw materials and finished goods in relation to production cycles and sales requirements? What is the condition of the inventory? To what extent is it obsolete? Note: be sure to get a breakdown and an analysis of all expenses, for example, amounts, trends, and categories, in order to assess the profitability of the seller's business, as well as to determine where post-closing expense savings can be obtained or economies of scale achieved. Sales and marketing strategies of the seller. 1. What are the seller's primary and secondary markets? What is the size of these markets? And what is the seller's market share within each market? What strategies are in place to expand this market share? What are the current trends affecting either the growth or the shrinkage of these particular markets? How does the seller segment and reach these markets? 2. Who are the seller's direct and indirect competitors? What are the respective strengths and weaknesses of each competitor? In what principal ways do companies within the seller's industry compete? For example, price, quality, or service? For each material competitor, the buyer should seek to obtain data on the competitor's products and services, geographic location, channel of distribution, market share, financial health, pricing policies, and reputation within the industry. 3. Who are the seller's typical customers? What demographic data have been assembled and analyzed? What are the customer's purchasing capabilities and patterns? Where are these customers principally located? What political, economic, social, or technological trends or changes are likely to affect the demographic makeup of the seller's customer base over the next 3 to 5 years? What are the key factors that influence the demand for the seller's goods and services? 4. What are the seller's primary and secondary distribution channels? What contracts are in place in relation to these channels? How could these channels or contracts be modified or improved? How will these channels overlap or conflict with the buyer's existing distribution channels? 5. What sales, advertising, public relations, and promotional campaigns and programs are currently in place at the seller's company? To what extent have these programs been effectively monitored and evaluated? Financial management of the seller. 1. Based on the financial statements and reports collected in connection with the legal due diligence, what key sales, income, and earnings trends have been identified? What effect will the proposed transaction have on these aspects of the seller's financial performance? What are the various costs incurred in connection with bringing the seller's products and services to the marketplace? In what ways can these costs be reduced or eliminated? 2. What are the seller's billing and collection procedures? How current are the seller's accounts receivables? What steps have been or can be taken to expedite the collection procedures and systems? How credible is the seller's existing accounting and financial control system? 3. What is the seller's capital structure? What are the seller's key financial liabilities and debt obligations? How do the seller's leverage ratios compare to industry norms? What are the seller's monthly debt service payments? How strong is the seller's relationship with creditors, lenders, and investors?